if we just drive away and call it good, Heavyset was going on, I don't have to explain all over again about my OUI, and you don't have to explain why you jumped out of your car and started slapping me and yelling about how I had a truckload of dead bodies. Did I actually say that? Ed asked, sounding bewildered. You know you did, Heavyset told him grimly. A voice with a wispy French-Canadian accent asked, Everything okay here, fellas? Nobody hurt, eh? Ralph, that you? The truck which had pulled over had Derry Dry Cleaners printed on the side, and Ralph recognized the driver as one of the Vachon brothers from Old Cape, probably Trigger, the youngest. That's me, Ralph said, and without knowing or asking himself why, he was operating purely on instinct at this point, he went to Trigger, put an arm around his shoulders. It was his day for that, it seemed, and led him back in the direction of the laundry truck. Them guys okay? Fine, fine, Ralph said. He glanced back and saw that Ed and Heavyset were standing by the truck bed with their heads together. Another cold spatter of rain fell, drumming on the blue tarpaulin like impatient fingers. A little fender bender, that's all. They're working it out. Beauty, beauty, Trigger Vachon said complacently. How that pretty little wife of yours, Ralph. Ralph twitched, suddenly feeling like a man who remembers at lunch that he's forgotten to turn off the stove before leaving for work. Jesus, he said, and looked at his watch, hoping for 5:15, 5:30 at the latest. Instead, he saw it was 6:10. Already 20 minutes past the time Carolyn expected him to bring her a bowl of soup and half a sandwich. She would be worried. In fact, with a lightning and a thunder booming through the empty apartment, she might be downright scared. And if it did rain, she would not be able to close the windows. She had almost no strength left in her hands. Ralph? Trigger asked. What's wrong? Nothing, he said. It's just that I got walking and lost all track of time. Then this accident happened, and... Could you give me a ride home, Trig? I'll pay you.
No need to pay nothing, Trigger said. It's on my way up in, Ralph. You think those guys gonna be all right? Ain't gonna take after each other or nothing?
No, Ralph said. I don't think so. Just one second. Sure. Ralph walked over to Ed. Are you okay with this? Are you getting it worked out? Yes, Ed replied. We're going to settle it privately. Why not? A little broken glass is all it really comes down to. He sounded completely like his old self now, and the big man in the white shirt was looking at him with something that was almost respect. Ralph still felt perplexed and uneasy about what had happened here, but he decided he was going to let it go. He liked Ed Deepnow a lot, but Ed was not his business this July. Carolyn was. Carolyn, and the thing which had started ticking in the walls of their bedroom, and inside her, late at night. Great, he told Ed. I'm headed home. I make Carolyn her supper these days, and I'm running way late. He started to turn away. The heavy-set man stopped him with an outstretched hand. John Tandy, he said. He shook it. Ralph Roberts, pleased to meet you. Tandy smiled. Under the circumstances, I kind of doubt that. But I'm real glad you showed up when you did. For a few seconds there, I really thought him and me was going to tangle. So did I, Ralph thought, but didn't say. He looked at Ed, his troubled eye taking in the unfamiliar T-shirt clinging to Ed's stalk-thin midriff and the white silk scarf with the Chinese red figures embroidered on it. He didn't entirely like the look in Ed's eyes when they met his. Ed was perhaps not all the way back after all. Sure you're okay? Ralph asked him. He wanted to go, wanted to get back to Carolyn, and yet he was somehow reluctant. The feeling that this situation was about 9 miles from right persisted. Yes, fine, Ed said quickly, and gave him a big smile which did not reach his dark blue eyes. They studied Ralph carefully, as if asking how much he had seen, and how much, hey, hey, Susan Day, he would remember later on. The interior of Trigger Vachon's truck smelled of clean, freshly pressed clothes, an aroma which for some reason always reminded Ralph of fresh bread. There was no passenger seat, so he stood with one hand wrapped around the door handle and the other gripping the edge of a Danduck's laundry basket. Man, that looked like some strange go-on back there, Trigger said, glancing into his outside mirror. You don't know the half of it, Ralph replied.
I know the guy driving the rice burner, Deepno his name is. He got a pretty little wife, sends stuff out sometime. Seemed like a nice fella, most usually. He sure wasn't himself today, Ralph said. I had a bug up his ass, did he? He had a whole damn ant farm up there, I think. Trigger laughed hard at that, pounding the worn black plastic of the big steering wheel. Whole damn ant farm! Beauty, beauty! I'm saving that one, me. Trigger wiped his streaming eyes with a handkerchief almost the size of a tablecloth. Look to me like Mr. Deepno come out that airport service gate, him. That's right, he did. You need a pass to use that way, Trigger said. How Mr. D get a pass, you think? Ralph thought it over, frowning, then shook his head. I don't know. It never even occurred to me. I'll have to ask him next time I see him. You do that, Trigger said, and ask him how them ants doing. This stimulated a fresh throw of laughter, which in turn occasioned more flourishes of the comic opera handkerchief. As they turned off the extension and onto Harris Avenue proper, the storm finally broke. There was no hail, but the rain came in an extravagant summer flood, so heavy at first that Trigger had to slow the panel truck to a crawl. Wow, he said respectfully. This remind me of the big storm back in 85, when half of downtown fell in a damn canal. Remember that, Ralph? Yes, Ralph said. Let's hope it doesn't happen again. Nah, Trigger said, grinning and peering past his extravagantly flapping windshield wipers. They got the drainage system all fixed up now. Beauty! A combination of the cold rain and the warm cab caused the bottom half of the windshield to steam up. Without thinking, Ralph reached out a finger and drew a figure in the steam. What's that? Trigger asked. I don't know, really. Looks Chinese, doesn't it? It was on the scarf Ed Deepno was wearing. Look a little familiar to me, Trigger said, glancing at it again. Then he snorted and flapped a hand. Listen to me, would you? Only thing I can say in Chinese is Mu Gu Gai Pan. Ralph smiled, but didn't seem to have a laugh in him. It was Carolyn. Now that he'd remembered her, he couldn't stop thinking about her, couldn't stop imagining the windows open and the curtains streaming like Edward Gorey ghost arms as the rain poured in. You still live in that two-story across from the Red Apple? Yes. Trigger pulled into the curb, the wheels of the truck spraying up big fans of water. The rain was still pouring down in sheets. Thunder cracked and lightning raced it across the sky. You better stay right here with me for a little bit, Trigger said. She'll let up in a minute or two. I'll be all right. Ralph didn't think anything could keep him in the truck a second longer, not even handcuffs. Concern had become gnawing intuition. Thanks, Trig. Wait a sec. Let me give you a piece of plastic. You can put it over your head like a rain hat. No, that's okay. No problem. Thanks. I'll just... There seemed to be no way of finishing whatever it was he was trying to say. And now what he felt was close to panic. He shoved the truck's passenger door back on its track and jumped out, landing ankle-deep in the cold water racing down the gutter. He gave Trigger a final wave without looking back, then hurried up the walk to the house he and Carolyn shared with Bill McGovern, feeling in his pocket for his latchkey as he went. When he reached the porch steps, he saw he wouldn't need it. The door was standing ajar. Bill, who lived downstairs, often forgot to lock it, and Ralph would rather think it had been him than think that Carolyn had wandered out to look for him and been caught in the storm. That was a possibility Ralph did not even want to consider. He hurried into the shadowy foyer, wincing as thunder banged deafeningly overhead, and crossed to the foot of the stairs. He paused there a moment, hand on the newel post of the banister, listening to rainwater drip from his soaked pants and shirt onto the hardwood floor. Then he started up, wanting to run but no longer able to find the next gear up from a fast walk. His heart was beating hard and fast in his chest. His soaked sneakers were clammy canvas anchors dragging at his feet. And for some reason, he kept seeing the way Ed Deepno's head had moved when he got out of his Datsun. Those stiff, quick jabs that made him look like a rooster spoiling for a fight. The third riser creaked loudly, as it always did, and the sound provoked hurried footsteps from above. They were no relief because they weren't Carolyn's. He knew that at once. And when Bill McGovern leaned over the rail, his face pale and worried beneath his trademark Panama hat, Ralph wasn't really surprised.
All the way back from the extension, he had felt that something was wrong, hadn't he? Yes, but under the circumstances, that hardly qualified as precognition. When things reached a certain degree of wrongness, he was discovering, they could no longer be redeemed or turned around. They just kept going wronger and wronger. He supposed that on some level or other, he'd always known that. What he had never suspected was how long that wrong road could be. "Ralph," Bill called down, "thank God, Carolyn's having... Well, I guess it's some sort of seizure. I just dialed 911, asked them to send an ambulance." Ralph discovered he could run up the rest of the stairs after all. She was lying half in and half out of the kitchen, with her hair in her face. Ralph thought there was something particularly horrible about that. It looked sloppy. And if there was one thing Carolyn refused to be, it was sloppy. He knelt beside her and brushed the hair away from her eyes and forehead. The skin beneath his fingers felt as chilly as his feet inside his soaked sneakers. "I wanted to put her on the couch, but she's too heavy for me," Bill said nervously. He'd taken off his Panama and was fiddling nervously with the band. "My back, you know?" "I know, Bill. It's okay," Ralph said. He slid his arms under Carolyn and picked her up. She did not feel heavy to him at all, but light, almost as light as a milkweed pod, which is ready to burst open and disgorge its filaments into the wind. "Thank God you were here." "I almost wasn't," Bill replied, following Ralph into the living room and still fiddling with his hat. He made Ralph think of old Dorrance Marsteller with his book of poems. "I wouldn't touch him any more if I were you," old Dorrance had said. "I can't see your hands." "I was on my way out when I heard a hell of a thud. It must have been her falling." Bill looked around the storm-darkened living room, his face somehow distraught and avid at the same time, his eyes seeming to search for something that wasn't there. Then they brightened. "The door," he said. I'll bet it's still open. It'll be raining in. I'll be right back, Ralph." He hurried out. Ralph barely noticed. The day had taken on the surreal aspects of a nightmare. The ticking was the worst. He could hear it in the walls, so loud now that even the thunder could not blot it out. He put Carolyn on the couch and knelt beside her. Her respiration was fast and shallow, and her breath was terrible. Ralph did not turn away from it, however. "Hang in there, sweetheart," he said. He picked up one of her hands, it was almost as clammy as her brow had been, and kissed it gently. "You just hang in there. It's fine. Everything's fine." But it wasn't fine. The ticking sound meant that nothing was fine. It wasn't in the walls either. It had never been in the walls, but only in his wife, in Carolyn. It was in his dear one. She was slipping away from him. And what would he ever do without her? "You just hang on," he said. "Hang on, you hear me?" He kissed her hand again and held it against his cheek. And when he heard the wobble of the approaching ambulance, he began to cry. She came around in the ambulance as it sped across Derry. The sun was already out again, the wet streets steaming. And at first she talked such gibberish that Ralph was sure she had suffered a stroke. Then, just as she began to clear up and speak coherently, a second convulsion struck, and it took both Ralph and one of the paramedics who had answered the call to hold her down. It wasn't Dr. Litchfield who came to see Ralph in the third-floor waiting room early that evening, but Dr. Jamal, the neurologist. Jamal talked to him in a low, soothing voice, telling him that Carolyn was now stabilized, that they were going to keep her overnight, just to be safe, but that she would be able to go home in the morning. There were going to be some new medications, drugs that were expensive, yes, but also quite wonderful. "We must not be losing the hope, Mr. Roberts," Dr. Jamal said. "No," Ralph said, "I suppose not. Will there be more of these, Dr. Jamal?" Dr. Jamal smiled. He spoke in a quiet voice that was rendered somehow even more comforting by his soft Indian accent. And although Dr. Jamal did not come right out and tell him that Carolyn was going to die, he came as close as anyone ever did during that long year in which she battled to stay alive. "The new medications," Jamal said, would probably prevent any further seizures. But things have reached a stage where all predictions had to be taken with the grains of salt. The tumor was spreading in spite of everything they had tried, unfortunately. The motor control problems may show up next, Dr. Jamal said in his comforting voice. And I am seeing some deterioration in the eyesight, I'm afraid. Can I spend the night with her? Ralph asked quietly. She'll sleep better if I do. He paused and added, so will I. Of course, Dr. Jamal said, brightening. That is a fine idea. Yes, Ralph said heavily. I think so, too. So he sat beside his sleeping wife, and he listened to the ticking that was not in the walls, and he thought, someday soon, maybe this fall, maybe this winter, I will be back in this room with her. It had the feel not of speculation, but of prophecy, and he leaned over and put his head on the white sheet that covered his wife's breast. He didn't want to cry again, but did a little anyway. That ticking, so loud and so steady. I'd like to get hold of what's making that sound, he thought. I'd stamp it until it was so many pieces scattered across the floor. With God as my witness, I would. He fell asleep in his chair a little after midnight, and when he woke the next morning, the air was cooler than it had been in weeks, and Carolyn was wide awake, coherent and bright-eyed. She seemed, in fact, hardly to be sick at all. Ralph took her home and began the not inconsiderable job of making her last months as comfortable as possible. It was a long while before he thought of Ed Deepnow again, even after he began to see the bruises on Helen Deepnow's face. It was a long time before he thought of Ed again. As that summer became fall, and as that fall darkened down toward Carolyn's final winter, Ralph's thoughts were occupied more and more by the death watch, which seemed to tick louder and louder even as it slowed down. But he had no trouble sleeping. That came later. Part 1. Little Bald Doctors. There is a gulf fixed between those who can sleep and those who cannot. It is one of the great divisions of the human race. Iris Murdoch, Nuns and Soldiers. About a month after the death of his wife, Ralph Roberts began to suffer from insomnia for the first time in his life. The problem was mild to begin with, but it grew steadily worse. 6 months after the first interruptions in his heretofore unremarkable sleep cycle, Ralph had reached a state of misery he could hardly credit, let alone accept. Toward the end of the summer of 1993, he began to wonder what it would be like to spend his remaining years on Earth in a starry-eyed daze of wakefulness. Of course, it wouldn't come to that, he told himself. It never does. But was that true? He didn't really know. That was the devil of it. And the books on the subject Mike Hanlon steered him to down at the Derry Public Library weren't much help. There were several on sleep disorders, but they seemed to contradict one another. Some called insomnia a symptom, others called it a disease, and at least one called it a myth. The problem went further than that, however. So far as Ralph could tell from the books, no one seemed exactly sure what sleep itself was, how it worked, or what it did. He knew he should quit playing amateur researcher and go to the doctor, but he found that surprisingly hard to do. He supposed he still bore Dr. Litchfield a grudge. It was Litchfield, after all, who had originally diagnosed Carolyn's brain tumor as tension headaches, except Ralph had an idea that Litchfield, a lifelong bachelor, might actually have believed that Carolyn was suffering from nothing but a moderate case of the vapors. And Litchfield, who had made himself as scarce as medically possible once Carolyn was diagnosed. Ralph was positive that if he had asked the man about that point blank, Litchfield would have said he had handed the case off to Jamal, the specialist. All quite proper and above board. Yes, except Ralph had made it his business to get a good look into Litchfield's eyes on the few occasions he had seen him between Carolyn's first convulsions last July and her death this March. And Ralph thought that what he'd seen in those eyes was a mixture of unease and guilt. It was the look of a man trying very hard to forget he is fucked up. Ralph believed the only reason he could still look at Litchfield without wanting to knock his block off was because Dr. Jamal had told him that an earlier diagnosis probably would have made no difference. By the time Carolyn's headache started, the tumor was already well entrenched, and no doubt sending out little bursts of bad cells to other areas of the brain like malignant care packages. In late April, Dr. Jamal had left to establish a practice in southern Connecticut, and Ralph missed him. He thought that he could have talked about his sleeplessness to Dr. Jamal, and he had an idea that Jamal would have listened in a way Litchfield wouldn't, or couldn't. By late summer, Ralph had read enough about insomnia to know that the type with which he was afflicted, while not rare, was a lot less common than the usual slow-sleep insomnia. People unaffected by insomnia are usually in first-stage sleep 7 to 20 minutes after turning in. Slow sleepers, on the other hand, sometimes take as long as 3 hours to slip below the surface. And while normal sleepers begin to ramp down into third-stage sleep, what some of the old books called theta sleep, Ralph had discovered, 45 minutes or so after drifting off, slow sleepers usually took an additional hour or two to get down there. And on many nights, they did not get all the way down at all. They awoke unrefreshed, sometimes with unfocused memories of unpleasant, tangled dreams, more often with the mistaken impression that they had been awake all night. Following Carolyn's death, Ralph began to suffer from premature waking. He continued to go to bed most nights following the conclusion of the 11 o'clock news, and he continued to pop off to sleep almost at once. But instead of waking promptly at 6:55, 5 minutes before the clock radio alarm buzzed, he began to wake at 6. At first, he dismissed this as no more than the price of living with a slightly enlarged prostate and a 70-year-old set of kidneys. But he never seemed to have to go that badly when he woke up, and he found it impossible to get back to sleep even after he'd emptied what had accumulated. He simply lay in the bed he'd shared with Carolyn for so many years, waiting for it to be 5 of 7, quarter till anyway, so he could get up. Eventually he gave up even trying to drop off again. He simply lay there with his long-fingered, slightly swollen hands laced together on his chest, and stared up at the shadowy ceiling with eyes that felt as big as doorknobs. Sometimes he thought of Dr. Jamal down there in Westport, talking in a soft and comforting Indian accent, building up his little piece of the American dream. Sometimes he thought of places he and Carolyn had gone in the old days, and the one he kept coming back to was a hot afternoon at Sand Beach in Bar Harbor, the two of them sitting at a picnic table in their bathing suits, sitting under a big bright umbrella, eating sweet fried clams and drinking bud from long-neck bottles as they watched the sailboat scudding across the dark blue ocean. When had that been? 1964? 1967? Did it matter? Probably not. The alterations in his sleep schedule wouldn't have mattered either if they had ended there. Ralph would have adapted to the changes not just with ease, but with gratitude. All the books he hunted through that summer seemed to confirm one bit of folk wisdom he'd heard all his life. People slept less as they got older. If losing an hour or so a night was the only fee he had to pay for the dubious pleasure of being 70 years young, he would pay it gladly and consider himself well off. But it didn't end there. By the first week of May, Ralph was waking up to birdsong at 5:15 a.m. He tried earplugs for a few nights, although he doubted from the outset that they would work. It wasn't the newly returned birds that were waking him up, nor the occasional delivery truck backfire out on Harris Avenue. He'd always been the sort of guy who could sleep in the middle of a brass marching band, and he didn't think that had changed. What had changed was inside his head. There was a switch in there. Something was turning it on a little earlier each day, and Ralph hadn't the slightest idea of how to keep it from happening. By June, he was popping out of sleep like Jack out of his box at 4:30 a.m., 4:45 at the latest. And by the middle of July, Not quite as hot as July of 92, but bad enough, thanks very much. He was snapping to at around 4 o'clock. It was during those long, hot nights, taking up too little of the bed where he and Carolyn had made love on so many hot nights, and cold ones, that he began to consider what a hell his life would become if sleep departed entirely. In daylight, he was still able to scoff at the notion, but he was discovering certain dismal truths about F. Scott Fitzgerald's Dark Night of the Soul, and the grand prize winner was this. At 4:15 a.m., anything seems possible. Anything. During the days, he was able to go on telling himself that he was simply experiencing a readjustment of a sleep cycle, that his body was responding in perfectly normal fashion to a number of big changes in his life, retirement and the loss of his wife being the two biggest. He sometimes used the word loneliness when he thought about his new life, but he shied away from the dreaded D word, stuffing it back into the deep closet of his subconscious whenever it happened to glimmer for a moment in his thoughts. Loneliness was okay. Depression most certainly was not. Maybe you need to get more exercise, he thought. Do some walking, like you used to last summer. After all, you've been leading a pretty sedentary life. Get up, eat toast, read a book, watch some TV. Get a sandwich across the street in the Red Apple for lunch. Potter around in the garden a little. Maybe go to the library, or visit with Helen and the baby if they happen to be out. Eat supper. Maybe sit on the porch and visit with McGovern or Lois Chass for a while. Then what? Read a little more. Watch a little more TV. Wash up. Go to bed. Sedentary. Boring. No wonder you wake up early. Except that was crap. His life sounded sedentary, yes, no doubt, but it really wasn't. The garden was a good example. What he did out there was never going to win him any prizes, but it was a hell of a long way from pottering around. Most afternoons he weeded until sweat made a dark tree shape down the back of his shirt and spread damp circles at his armpits. And he was often trembling with exhaustion by the time he let himself go back inside. Punishment probably would have been closer to the mark than pottering. But punishment for what? Waking up before dawn? Ralph didn't know and didn't care. Working in the garden filled up a large piece of the afternoon. It took his mind off things he didn't really care to think of. And that was enough to justify the aching muscles and the occasional flights of black spots in front of his eyes. He began his extended visits to the garden shortly after the 4th of July, and continued all through August, long after the early crops had been harvested and the later ones had been hopelessly stunted by the lack of rain. "You ought to quit that," Bill McGovern told him one night as they sat on the porch, drinking lemonade. This was in mid-August, and Ralph had begun to wake up around 3:30 each morning. "It's got to be hazardous to your health. Worse, you look like a lunatic." "Maybe I am a lunatic," Ralph responded shortly, and either his tone or the look in his eyes must have been convincing, because McGovern changed the subject. He did begin walking again, nothing like the marathons of 92, but he usually managed 2 miles a day if it wasn't raining. His usual route took him down the perversely named Upmile Hill to the Derry Public Library, and then on to Back Pages, a used bookstore and newsstand on the corner of Witcham and Main. Back Pages stood next to a jumbled junkatorium called Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes. And as he passed this store one day during the August of his discontent, Ralph saw a new poster among the announcements of outdated bean suppers and ancient church socials, placed so it covered roughly half of a yellowing Pat Buchanan for President placard. The woman in the two photographs at the top of the poster was a pretty blonde in her late 30s or early 40s. But the style of the photos, unsmiling full face on the left, unsmiling profile on the right, plain white background in both, was unsettling enough to stop Ralph in his tracks. The photos made the woman look as if she belonged on a post office wall or in a TV docudrama. And that, the poster's printed matter made clear, was no accident. The photos were what stopped him, but it was the woman's name that held him. Wanted for murder, Susan Edwina Day. was printed across the top in big black letters, and below the simulated mugshots in red, "Stay out of our city." There was a small line of print at the very bottom of the poster. Ralph's close vision had deteriorated quite a bit since Carolyn's death. Gone to hell in a handbasket might actually have been a more accurate way of putting it. And he had to lean forward until his brow was pressed against the dirty show window of secondhand Rose, secondhand clothes, before he could decipher it. "Paid for by the Maine Life Watch Committee." Far down in his mind, a voice whispered, "Hey, hey, Susan Day, how many kids did you kill today?" Susan Day, Ralph recalled, was a political activist from either New York or Washington, the sort of fast-speaking woman who regularly drove taxi drivers, barbers, and hard-hat construction workers into foaming frenzies. Why that particular little jangle of doggerel had come into his mind, however, he couldn't say. It was tagged to some memory that wouldn't quite come. Maybe his tired old brains were just cross-referencing that 60s Vietnam protest chant, the one which had gone, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" No, that's not it, he thought. Close, but no cigar. It was... Just before his mind could cough up Ed Deepnose's name and face, a voice spoke from almost beside him. "Earth to Ralph, Earth to Ralph, come in, Ralphie, baby." Roused out of his thoughts, Ralph turned toward the voice. He was both shocked and amused to find he had almost been asleep on his feet. Christ, he thought, you never know how important sleep is until you miss a little. Then all the floors start to tilt, and all the corners on things start to round off. It was Hamilton Davenport, the proprietor of Back Pages, who had spoken to him. He was stocking the library cart he kept in front of his shop with brightly jacketed paperbacks. His old corncob pipe, to Ralph had always looked like the stack of a model steamship, jutted from the corner of his mouth, sending little puffs of blue smoke into the hot, bright air. Winston Smith, his old gray tomcat, sat in the open doorway of the shop with his tail curled around his paws. He looked at Ralph with yellow-eyed indifference, as if to say, "You think you know old, my friend? I'm here to testify you don't know dick about getting old." "Sheesh, Ralph," Davenport said. "I must have called your name at least 3 times. "I guess I was wool gathering," Ralph said. He stepped past the library cart, leaned in the doorway. Winston Smith held his place with regal indifference and grabbed the 2 papers he bought every day, a Boston Globe and a USA Today. The Derry News came right to the house, courtesy of Pat, the paperboy. He sometimes told people that he was sure one of the 3 papers was Comic Relief, but he'd never been able to make up his mind which one it was. "I haven't..." He broke off as Ed Deepnose's face came into his mind. It was Ed he'd heard that nasty little chant from. Last summer, out by the airport. And it really wasn't any wonder it had taken him a little while to retrieve the memory. Ed Deepnose was the last person in the world from whom you'd expect to hear something like that. "Ralphie?" Davenport said. "You just shut down on me." Ralph blinked. "Oh, sorry. I haven't been sleeping very well. That's what I started to say." "Bummer. But there are worse problems. Just drink a glass of warm milk and listen to some quiet music 30 minutes before bed." Ralph had begun to discover this summer that everyone in America apparently had a pet remedy for insomnia, some bit of bedtime magic that had been handed down through the generations like the family Bible. Bach's good, also Beethoven, and William Ackerman ain't bad. But the real trick, Davenport raised 1 finger impressively to emphasize this, is not to get up from your chair during that 30 minutes. Not for anything. Don't answer the phone. Don't wind up the dog and put out the alarm clock. Don't decide to brush your teeth. Nothing. Then when you do go to bed, bam, out like a light. "What if you're sitting there in your favorite easy chair and all at once you realize you have a call of nature?" Ralph asked. "These things can come on pretty suddenly when you get to be my age." "Do it in your pants," Davenport said promptly and burst out laughing. Ralph smiled, but it had a dutiful feel. His insomnia was rapidly losing whatever marginal humor value it might once have had. "In your pants," Ham chortled. He slapped the library cart and wagged his head back and forth. Ralph happened to glance down at the cat. Winston Smith looked blandly back at him, and to Ralph his calm yellow gaze seemed to say, "Yes, that's right. He's a fool, but he's my fool." "Not bad, huh? Hamilton Davenport, master of the snappy comeback. Do it in your..." He snorted laughter, shook his head, then took the $2 bills Ralph was holding out. He slipped them into the pocket of his short red apron and came out with some change. "That about right?" "You bet. Thanks, Ham." "Uh-huh. And all joking aside, try the music. It really works. Mellows out your brain waves or something." "I will." And the devil of it was, he probably would, as he had already tried Mrs. Rappaport's lemon and hot water recipe, and Shauna McClure's advice on how to clear his mind by slowing his respiration and concentrating on the word cool. Except when Shauna said it, the word came out cool. When you were trying to deal with a slow but relentless erosion of your good sleep time, any folk remedy started to look good. Ralph started to turn away, then turned back. "What's with that poster next door?" Ham Davenport wrinkled his nose.